It's here and now. Open medieval scholar Bruce Holzinger's debut novel, and you are immediately immersed in another world, London, 1385. Poet Geoffrey Chaucer has yet to complete The Canterbury Tales, now a staple in college classes. And a book that has been written is something that people are willing to kill for because it appears to predict the death of a king. Chaucer charges his friend John Gower, a lesser poet, with finding that book because, as Chaucer says, this job needs a subterranean man, a man who knows this city like the lines of his knuckles, its secrets and surprises. Gower is that man. He's a trader of information, something he came upon. Well, let him explain.
The second son of a moderately wealthy knight has some choices. The law, the royal bureaucracy, Oxford or Cambridge, the life of a monk or a priest. I would rather have trapped Grayling in the Severn for a living than taken holy orders, and it was clear that my poetry would never see the lavishments from patrons that Chaucer's increasingly enjoyed. Yet I shall never forget the thrill I felt when that first coin of another man's vice fell into my lap and I realized what I had and how to use it.
Got that? It might take a minute, but soon the rhythms of medieval speech and life become as familiar as, well, reading A Game of Thrones. Bruce Holzinger's new book is called A Burnable Book. We meet not only Gower and Chaucer, but butchers and prostitutes, all caught up in a plot against King Richard II. Bruce Holzinger is currently on leave from his job as a professor at the University of Virginia. He joins us from WCVE in Richmond to talk about it all. Bruce, welcome.
Thank you very much. Nice to be here.
And how much fun did you have?
I had so much fun writing this book. It was one of the great pleasures of my life, one of the great intellectual challenges of my life, too.
Well, because we have to say, if people are thinking, oh, Chaucer, you know, he's somewhat bawdy. I remember that. It was a little bit randy. Someone stuck their butt out a window. They made fart jokes. This is, I actually gave this book to a young person to read and wondered if I should, because this really tells what life was like for prostitutes and church leaders who were seeing prostitutes. I mean, this goes beyond bawdy.
It's way beyond body. I think the Middle Ages are beyond body. This was a society that was, its literature was obsessed with the dark side of life. A lot of medieval literature is crime literature. Chaucer's Pardoner's Tale tells us about a triple homicide. The Icelandic sagas and medieval drama are all obsessed with crime and true crime. So it was a very dark period, and Chaucer is a poet who's not just interested in the sunny, bawdy side of life, but in the darker sides of life, too.
Well, in this case, in a very dark tale about a potential prophecy that the king is going to be killed. How much of this is real? Start with Chaucer himself in this book, his character in this book. Was he really controller of the customs for the port of London?
Yes, he was. He was the controller of the wool custom, which was a royal appointment. Soon after the events set in this book, he became Justice of the Peace for the County of Kent and also a member of Parliament. And Chaucer had a very public life. He was a public official.
And how about John Gower, who becomes our guide and narrator largely through the book? A lesser poet, you write, but a real one?
Absolutely a real one. And we know a lot less about Gower than we do about Chaucer. His life seems not to have been documented as well. But what we do know is very intriguing. He was a close and apparently longtime friend of Chaucer. And the way I like to imagine his literary friendship with Chaucer, in some ways Gower plays, in this book anyway, Gower plays Salieri to Chaucer's Mozart. And I like that idea of a kind of slightly bitter, rivalrous, artistic friendship. And that's how I imagine their relationship.
Did you know, were you walking around, you are a medieval scholar, were you walking around with all of this information? Or, and I'm wondering, because you say in a note to the reader, after half a career spent studying and teaching the literature of the Middle Ages, I found it a surprise to realize I couldn't answer a simple question from my younger son, did they have forks?
So yes.
You had to do research. So how much of this came out of research even you had to do? And how much was just, this is too good, this information. There's got to be a novel here.
Well, I think part of it is that I taught for so long and thought I could do this. And when I sat down and started to write this story, it was like every two sentences there'd be a speed bump there where I had to slow down and look something up. And I started to realize, you know, I know so much less about this period. But that was a remarkable and pleasurable process to realize the depth of my ignorance and to remedy it.
Yeah. Well, and what about the language? It's very familiar in some places here. I've just opened a page. She felt a dark and secret thrill. We get that. Then, as we just heard, I would rather have trapped Grayling on the Severn. What does that mean? And how much was it important for you to speak in the language of the time, even though there are times when I felt myself, you know, thinking, okay, I might even need to look some of this up.
Yeah, well, grayling is a kind of fish. The Severn is a river. What I was trying to do there is simply imagine how he might have thought about his situation. But one of the great things about working with medieval sources is every old word is an archive in itself, and you can really see Middle English vocabulary coming to life in medieval poetry. And one of the things I like to do is have unfamiliar words that I don't think you have to look them up, but having the context of the story explain them, and have in every case, I want them to be at the service of the story, because I think the story has to come first.
Well, and I didn't look them up. I mean, because you're right, because they become a groundswell that pull you along through the book, and suddenly you're in that time. And we love to be in that time. Look around at all the popular literature right now. I mentioned Game of Thrones, but it feels as if everybody's returning to this sort of mystical medieval time to write. Is that part of what prompted you as well? You know, I'm a scholar in this time period.
It is, and I'm also very interested in the endurance of the Middle Ages in the modern world. And so many of our institutions come from that period. Universities, jury trials, in some ways, government bureaucracies. The printing press is an invention of the Middle Ages, not an invention of the Renaissance. And I think that we definitely have so much of that still with us, still part of our culture and our language, certainly in the Western world.
Is that why you make a book the centerpiece of the novel, the burnable book of the title?
Yes. This book is something that I thought very carefully about, and I actually wrote the prophecies from beginning to end before starting to tell the story. So the 13th prophecy, the one that foretells the death of Richard II, they're all written in alliterative verse, the kind of poetry that you'd find in Sir Gawain and the Green Knight. And I tried to do it in such a way that each prophecy would encrypt some secrets that the Gower and the other figures have to trace down and decipher in order to figure out who's behind this conspiracy and who's behind this book. And medieval culture had a very particular way of thinking about books and about written language. Books were material things. They're written on animal skin. The culture is very self-conscious about that, about what it means to write on skin, what it means to have skin. The body of Christ is a charter to be written on. Human flesh is a book. So those kinds of analogies, those kinds of metaphors between the book and the body, between writing and the flesh, those are very important for this culture, and they're things that I tried to bring out in this novel.
Boy, when are you coming back from your leave of absence so we can take your course?
I teach again in the fall.
Well, it just sounds terrific. I mean, it's a rare book where the characters can make a joke about Sir Gawain and Lancelot, and you can get it. It's a joke of the day.
And to be honest, there are a few little inside jokes from my medievalist colleagues that will get a laugh in an audience of medievalists more than at your average bookstore.
Can you give us one of those medieval jokes?
Yes, one of them is when Gower is talking about Chaucer, and he says, "Chaucer gave me that elvish smile of his." And Chaucer, in a very self-deprecating moment in the Canterbury Tales, describes a character that's supposed to be him, or at least supposed to be the narrator of the frame narrative in the Canterbury Tales, describes him as elvish.
You medieval scholars are a laugh
riot. Back-slapping, aren't we? Isn't it just...
Bruce Holzinger, his debut novel is a burnable book. It is just a very compelling one as well. Bruce Holzinger, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin. It's been a pleasure.
And again, Jeremy, maybe not for kids. It was pretty steamy back in those medieval times, it turns out.
I think we might be able to get a medieval reference on the show every day. I think Jerry Brown, the governor of California, brought up medieval times last week when he was talking about the high-speed train.
They're in now. Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from GEICO, offering a variety of insurance products, including auto, renters, boat, and motorcycle. More at geico.com or 1-800-947-AUTO.